So, excuse me, I'm not sick, but I've had a, I got the flu like a month ago, and then just a kind of, I've been better for a long time, but just a trailing post-viral, some cough, so. So I wanted to speak about power and surrender and idealization and teacher-student relationships. I feel this often after residential retreats, but there was one particular retreat. Whereas it was a lot of relatively new yogis, many of whom had not been sitting for so long, and it was a big group, and it was at the Garrison Institute, which is this like really kind of, you know, super high ceiling, like just a majestic kind of setting, and it was partially silent retreat, and then partially kind of more workshop oriented. And there was so much energy coursing through the room that as I sat in the closing circle, there's this just undifferentiated mix of sort of, you know, delight and grieving and letting go and excitement and gratitude and disorientation and depletion. And it was just, you know, so palpable. And people just felt very porous and receptive. And it struck me in that moment that if we had intended to start a cult, we would have run the retreat in almost exactly the same way. You know, like, putting people into silence and telling them to let go, and anytime doubt arises, telling them to let that go too, and the rigors of silent practice and the kind of encouragement to move as deeply as possible into the center of your being, and it, you know, to speak to one another, to speak to oneself about what one cares most for, and is a very kind of surrendered, porous state, right? And that needs to be held very carefully. How we as students, as practitioners, relate to that, and how teachers actually use and shape that, use their power, you know, for the welfare of others, is a very tender terrain. And in a Dharma life, in the course of a path of Dharma practice, these themes of you know, of surrender is also paired with a certain kind of encouragement for self-reliance. So on the one hand, you hear that Zen koan, like if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him, right? Of like, what do you know so deeply that even if the Buddha showed up and said, no, Matthew, that's not true, we could stand in our knowing and just say, no, this is so. Yeah. To become independent in the Dharma. It's the phrase. Like, that is one side of this path. But this path also has this deep dimension of surrendering. Surrendering. And this is not just in the Buddhist path, this is in every religious tradition, right? So Augustine's Confessions. So Saint Augustine says, we are but a particle of thy creation. Thou awakest us to delight in thee praise, for thou made us for thyself, and our heart is restless until it repose in thee. Hide not thee face from me. Let me die, lest I die. Only let me see thy face. Narrow is the mansion of my soul. Enlarge it, that thou may enter in. You hear the kind of, you know, it's like, famously gorgeous, like, gesture of surrender in the Christian tradition. What does that look like in the Buddhist, in the Dharma tradition? So maybe we begin by acknowledging that that part of us really wants to let go, surrender, let go of power. And then a part of us really clings to it, right? You can feel that ambivalence just in how you've navigated your own meditative path. Now, sometimes, of course, we've surrendered or been asked to surrender to bad ideas or troubled people or a culture that has not seen us for who we are, or institutions that are not born of love and wisdom. And so surrender always feels like some kind of imposition, or we feel compromised in the gesture of surrender, and that's so understandable. In me, you know, surrender was like not a natural posture. You know, when I got into practice, I did it so slowly, like just dipping my toe in. And just like almost immediately withdrawing it from the ocean of Dharma and just checking to make sure it wasn't creepy, you know, or something. Just like, it was so distrustful that people knew about happiness, you know? That was really it. Like, I just did not trust that there was a path, you know, where that was truly born of wisdom. And I was so wary about kind of the emotional impingement of getting involved in some religious, you know, organization or ideology, that it was just, I was just really, I just went very slowly. And that was fine. That was how I did it. That was how I was going to have to do it. And we can try to control our practice. We can try to sort of engineer how much we're willing to let go. We can kind of cling our way to a certain measure of freedom. Yeah. But at some point, yeah, at some point, it's enlarge the mansion of my soul, right? And we get down on our knees. So, you know, sometimes Buddhist practice and the secular mindfulness it's, you know, sometimes, and I'm involved in both sides, mostly in the Buddhist world, but some in the kind of more more secular mindfulness stuff. And sometimes the distinction that people make as well, the Buddhist side has the sila, has the conduct, the ethics, and the secular side doesn't have that so much. And my experience is that's not the case, that the ethical commitments are quite strong in the secular world, you know, secular mindfulness world. What is different, what distinguishes Buddha Dharma from some of the secular traditions is the depth of surrender that is asked for. Yeah. And, you know, in the more kind of secular settings, the teachers don't start with, like, the request for your entire life. Yeah. But that is the plea of the Dharma teacher. You know? And so we see the kind of limitations of this kind of ambivalent, half-hearted movement into practice. And as I said, sometimes that's that's necessary. We can't fake our way into sincerity or into feeling safe enough to let go. We just sort of keep dipping our toe, our foot, our leg in. And then there's some appreciation that, you know, the most kind of liberating practice happens when the ego is all out of moves, you know, when there really is that sense of surrender. Mindfulness itself is a kind of surrender, a kind of this radical willingness not to manipulate experience, to make peace with the imperfection of samsara, make peace with the human condition, to let go of control and ownership. These are all forms of surrender. To surrender to the path, even when you don't know where it's going or what it means or what it's going to do to your life, how it's going to transfigure what you think your life is, what you think you want, who you think you are. There have been many times in, especially in retreats, where sort of like everything in me was saying no, but there was something, the heart still was like, okay, I'll keep going. A kind of surrender without knowing, but trusting some kind of intuitive sense of that this, there's something redemptive about this path, and no matter where it goes, no matter what it leads, I'm not going to regret staying, of letting go for this moment more. And practice has a very different flavor when we do surrender in that way, because we're no longer trying to kind of engineer our healing or kind of titrate how much of the Dharma comes into our heart. It's just like, okay, here I am. You can take me. Yeah, practice. Go ahead. Do what you will to this heart. There's a quote from Adyashanti, the non-dual teacher, who kind of exemplifies this. He's got a flashy way with words, which you'll see momentarily. So, right? If you prefer smoke over fire, then get up now and leave. For I do not intend to perfume your mind's clothing with more sooty knowledge. No, I have something else in mind. Today I hold a flame in my left hand and a sword in my right. There will be no damage control today, for God is in a mood to plunder your riches and fling you so nakedly into such breathtaking poverty that all that will be left of you will be a tendency to shine. So, don't just sit around this flame choking on your mind, for this is no campfire song to mindlessly mantra yourself to sleep with. Jump now into the space between thoughts and exit this dream before I burn the damn place down. That's not the tradition I come from, but you can feel the potency of just like, it just wants everything, yeah? Everything you think you own, you are, you have, what your practice is. No, let go. So we surrender in a sense to the path, and we surrender in our own way to teachers. And this is exquisitely tender terrain. Now it's maybe even more charged in traditions that are more where the teacher-student model is much more kind of hierarchical, so more kind of guru model. You know, like one of my mentors was in the Tibetan tradition, and he went to India in the maybe 1970 or something, and was sitting with Kalu Rinpoche, and took some kind of vow to practice. And upon taking the vow, my mentor's kind of welcome into the tradition was Kalu Rinpoche saying to him, "Now I am your father. Learn Tibetan." And that was the instruction. Yeah. Yeah. Also different, right? The Kalyanamitta, spiritual friend model that is typifies the insight approach reduces, I would say, but does not eliminate the power imbalance. And that's okay. Ideally, like, power is used for the liberation of other hearts. And so it's not like there's some magic kind of number or like ratio of where the hierarchy is just right or something, where I think finding our way through what is a kind of appropriate measure of power for our teachers to hold, and how fluid and flexible must that power be, how can that be used most singularly for the welfare of others. And so, I usually the teachers kind of exercise their power invisibly, in a sense. Like, it's not called out as power exactly. And in some ways that makes it more effective. Yeah. It's like there's a little bit like breaking down the fourth wall or something, whereas like actually calling attention to the exercise of power. And I'm not dismissive of that. There's the more power a teacher has, the more deeply people will take to heart the Dharma teachings, in a sense. The more one can be encouraged to practice, to stay with it, to love oneself, to be careful with one's sila, careful with how we engage the world. And it's important, to to have people that we can look up to. I know in my practice, which of course is ongoing, and is still a student in most senses of the word, it's important to have idealizable figures, you know? Even if maybe that's a phase of practice and we sort of like, you know, at some point grow out of a purely idealized sense of the teacher, but that's actually important to be able to feel like, oh yeah, that's a worthy being or something. And in this dance of surrender and autonomy, it's very tender terrain and very intimate and very, in a sense, ripe for our own longings and our own, the kilesas, the defilements, all the goodness and all the confusion in us to arise in the form of a certain kind of transference, maybe we say. Yeah, that's the, in the therapy world, we would say that. And so, so Freud said, there is no love that does not reproduce infantile stereotypes. Yeah. That's the old school psychoanalytic view. There's no love that does not reproduce some childhood, you know, infantile dynamic. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm not in this world anymore really, but there's been a migration away from that kind of orthodox interpretation that anything that's evoked in adult relationships is like a perfect mirror image of infantile dynamics. You know, the psychotherapeutic world has moved to a model where, you know, it's like, yeah, to some extent we can't understand current relationships with a person, a friend, partner, or a teacher outside of the context of our past relationships, right? That's the context for understanding this new one, yeah? But it's not purely a kind of the past being projected. It's co-created past and present, what, you know, is shaping a certain kind of relationship. And a lot, you know, as I know from being a student, a lot gets evoked in us, you know, in the context of this relationship. Much of it quite positive and wholesome and onward leading, and also complicated of, yeah, of wanting to be, get some approval or be special, or there's a competitive kind of feelings, or, and also importantly, it's like in this realm of surrender and autonomy, that space is so charged that it's prone to be sexualized too, which is part of the complications, you know, in all religious traditions of the violation of sexual exploitation, the sort of importance of having, you know, codes of conduct where, given the kind of vulnerability and unequal power and hierarchy, that has to be tended to with exquisite care, right? And teachers too are not like exempt from this, right? So there's like in the therapy world, there's transference and counter-transference, right? what is evoked in a therapist, and at some level, I kind of think of, you know, we can think of a lot of our life as counter-transference, you know, like what gets evoked in us in this relational dynamic. And in the Dharma realm, you know, it's one, as a teacher, one needs to be very careful to not become identified with the projections of students. Yeah. That process happens quite subtly, and so sometimes it's, you know, we don't actually see that there's a certain kind of egoic imposition on students that's being made, a certain way in which the teacher is subtly making a demand for their own self-image to be amplified in some way, yeah, for one's own kind of narcissistic needs to be validated or accommodated in some way. And so the teacher has to watch very carefully how we are shaping that kind of relational field. Yeah. And teachers and students can get caught up in some of these some of this projection where maybe students rationalize the bad behavior of the teachers, and then we've seen this like endlessly. The teacher in some way is just continues to get their own needs that should not be met through teaching met, yeah? Just even purely emotional kind of needs. And so so the motivation to teach, in a sense, needs to be purified again and again. You know, and there's a, just in the same way that with our practice, like we purify our intention to care, we purify the heart. The teaching, this gesture of teaching, and the kind of surrender that is requested, means that the teacher needs to be very clear that all of this is dedicated to the welfare of the practitioner. That the teaching is truly offered freely. You know, that there are no strings attached, and the most subtle strings are the kind of emotional strings of a certain need for approval or love or honor or something. And so, just as the student has a practice, the teacher has a practice to try to distill out that, to make the offering more and more free. And this is why sila is, as I alluded to, is so central. These are like the guardrails that in the kind of disorienting unfolding of the path of, you know, sometimes just not knowing where things are going, not knowing what is this path, like where is this taking me, like And the teacher is not knowing either. Where is this part? What? How is this going to unfold? How? It's like, okay, we have our sila. We have our like deep commitments to non-harming, to non-exploitation, to honoring love in all spheres of our lives. And that provides a kind of... the guardrails in a way in navigating this very complex realm of surrender and power and idealization and transference and the unfolding of the heart. So, I wanted to leave time for us to have some discussion about this, and so these themes of like surrender on the path, what does that word mean to you? What is that gesture of the heart? How vulnerable does that feel? How natural does that feel? And these reflections that it is, as I said, it's tender terrain to even name this student-teacher dynamic and how power is exercised and the ways in which it feels very clean, wholesome, beautiful, freely offered, and the ways in which it feels like, oh, there's something weird in the relational field, and how do we navigate that, and how do we foster communities that are based on accountability and transparency with open feedback loops. And these are all themes close to my heart. So, so it's open for any questions, comments. Thanks, please.
So I think this is very interesting. One of my first meditation practices was with a guru situation, an ashram, and people living, and really being under the there was much more power happening there. Now, I really wanted to be in a place where I could learn to meditate and I could have people to practice with. Mm-hmm. But there was always this huge sense of just ease, you know, there. Now, some of the people I would be with, it felt okay, and I felt, yes, that there was a certain amount of surrender that one could have. But the bottom line was, it was really not a good model for me, and there was a part of me that just really did not feel like it was totally safe. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, I was probably correct. Mm-hmm. I was probably correct. And as I said earlier, when I looked for different places to go to meditate with groups of people, and a lot of times it would be that kind of... people asking for something from me that I really wasn't willing to give, and it wasn't necessarily, but just that I didn't feel that it was safe. And like I told you, when I walked into the Sangha with Phil teaching and he was there, it was like I felt I had gone home. I really did, and it was just a beautiful feeling that I felt that that there was no other. There was nothing, there was no strings, there was no stickiness attached, and that, to me, I have eternal gratitude for. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, it's, to surrender entails a measure, a deep measure of safety, yeah, and, to surrender, to go against one's intuitions, to not feel totally at home, to not feel totally safe, and to override that because the longing is so deep, or some the pain is so deep, or something. It's like, no. Let's just like really check out, like, okay, what feels like we can trust. And it, to some extent, surrendering is never going to feel totally safe, but we should be trusting the field, you know. And that's part of why, the ethics is like, the ethics is in it, kind of like just inextricable from the potency of the teaching, you know. And so it's just totally melted together. And if you're asking for people to really let go, to surrender, you need to be pristine.
Thank you for the talk. I just wanted to mention that, in case anybody hasn't, or if they want to hear the female perspective, the Tenzin Palmo book, Cave in the Snow, is really fun and funny, the way that she describes this relationship of teacher to student.
Mm. Great.
So that's a recommendation from me.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Your talk was really taking me back to an experience that I've been having over the last 5 years. Mm. I started going at Whistle Stop, the senior center, to what was basically a Qigong class that would last for an hour. And I could only stay for a half an hour and then bust out of there because I had another commitment to a group I was helping with. But I was so listening to this guy, I was just so caught up in my own embarrassment about all these movements and gestures and with people that, you know, I saw at Whistle Stop, and, you know, there were some other relationships with and so on. Listening to your talk tonight, Since that time, this guy's no longer teaching Whistle Stop. He teaches at a church in San Anselmo, and he leads a class there that lasts an hour and a half, and it's just transformed me in so many ways. It turns out this guy is a poet, and he starts by just reading a couple minutes of a poem that he's written and shares that, and then he goes into all these, he's doing these movements, and sometimes he's not giving us instructions of how to do the movements. All of his verbalizations are sharing, as you do this moment, notice certain things. And it's a mindfulness exercise combined with what he describes, and what I'm experiencing now is an hour and a half self-body massage. You know, and I walk out of there and I'm just feeling so much more in touch with myself, grounded, and just my mind is quiet. Unless I've been on my own disturbing process. If anyone here is interested in hearing more about how they might come to attend this class, it's offered free. It's donation only for an hour and a half every Tuesday from...
Well, people can come up to you. Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for raising this topic, because it's a very important topic. Trust between the student and the teacher is paramount, and it's subtle in many ways, because the teacher may try to direct the student in a certain direction that they feel is useful to that student. But on the other hand, the power of disapproval can be a tool for power as opposed to a tool for directing somebody in the right direction. So, you know, I mean, I've had experiences in my younger days with where I felt it was not, for a long time, I was trusting very much, you know, that this was, whatever was the direction was for my benefit, and then at some point I lost that trust, and then to gain it again becomes much more difficult.
Yeah.
So anyway, I appreciate your bringing this up because it's not direct power always, it's subtle power in terms of disapproval, because all of a sudden if a teacher disapproves and the student takes it to heart, then you've got you've established a power link, and now it's very subtle.
Yeah, you know, in the especially as we get more quiet and in the context of retreat, it's like we become even more porous and more, in a sense, there's a certain kind of, almost psychological regression where we're like really undefended, really suggestible. Like you, just like you're saying, just that like gesture of disapproval or something is enough to cut deeply or something like that. And that's some of why there's an attempt, you know, especially in the retreat environment, but even anywhere in a Dharma field, to just be very conscious of how we're impacting each other and what we're asking for, you know, from each other, and for that to be, you know, it's money, sex, power. That's where things go sideways, you know. And so you really have to like watch carefully. Yeah, how is that functioning? Yes.
I was really taken by the distinction between the secular mindfulness and the Buddhist path, about the kind of real genuine dedication, I mean, the deeper commitment to, and which I had never really kind of gotten that distinction. I think that's a really actually, you know, very accurate. And but one of the things I'm thinking about is that being in a community like we're in Sangha, I really appreciate the value of the community as well, supporting each other in the depth of the practice, and not just partly because we have different teachers all the time.
Right.
So we almost depend on each other for commitment to keeping going, keeping coming, that sort of thing, and keeping, you know, deepening our practice.
I'm a person who always felt bad because I never found a teacher. Anyway, I mean, I don't feel bad now.
What does a teacher mean to you?
Well, I did find teachers. I mean, I practiced with people and I learned from people, and some of them I, like, you know, was so drawn to and giddy around, and Marin Sangha coming in the beginning, that it wasn't so easy to come, but repeatedly coming developed a depth of practice, but still, I just remember for years, you know, hearing, oh, you should have a teacher. Anyway, feeling like I should find, I don't know, a teacher, right? That I have a one-on-one relationship with to deepen my practice, and that never really happened exactly like that. I think it's good. I think it's turned out fine, but I know I felt, you know, like searching and less than, or I just had the less than already, but it fed into that.
Hmm. And did it feel like you were, what is your relationship to surrender?
Well, my relationship with surrender is I sort of, in a lot of ways, I really trust surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a lot of ways, I surrender to the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I feel safe with having the opportunity, and I'm willing to take that journey because I have the opportunity. And so I guess I've had a lot of different opportunities really to surrender, but not with ongoing long time sense of relationship with a teacher.
Yeah. Well, I do, you know, I see value. And, you know, and when people, when teachers say, oh, my teacher, you know, like, that means a lot of different things to people, you know, and, you know, what people are alluding to when we say my teacher, that might be a very deep personal one-on-one contact that unfolded over decades, or that might mean somebody we sat retreat with a lot but didn't have any kind of relationship outside of that. That might mean somebody we had even less contact with. And so my experience is there's definitely some value in sort of drilling down deeply with one particular teacher, regardless of how much personal contact there is. But at the same time, I do feel like sometimes it's possible to hide out in one particular approach to practice. And my experience has been that in having different teachers, that, you know, different traditions, it's like each of those teachers shines a light on a different part of my neurosis. You know, it's like, and I can get super comfortable. I just sort of like, all right, I just do this, you know, like, I know how to do it, you know. And then you go practice in a different, with a different approach, a different system, different something. It's like, what? Oh, yeah, there's a whole other kind of bunch of skills, emotional, attentional, introspective skills that are not developed in this other system. And so there is real value in the kind of diversity of experience too. Okay. Maybe last one, and then we'll have a metta.
I was very interested in the invitation to look at our relationship with surrender. Because when I first heard the Dharma, I really resented how impersonal it was.
Mm-hmm.
People would ask a question on retreat, and the answer always seemed so impersonal to me, and I resented that.
Yeah.
And as I've developed my practice, I've come to appreciate that's an example of not self. That's an example of the universality of dukkha. It's an example of impermanence. I find great comfort in surrendering to those three characteristics. It takes the burden off me of trying to manage my life. It's not about me, it's not permanent, and it's not perfect. And that really helps me surrender to what is instead of spending so much energy wishing it were otherwise. So I surrender to the truth of impermanence and the truth of dukkha and the truth of not self. And I find that totally, totally liberating.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you. Thank you.